This is recorded on the morning of May 23rd, 1972, in the offices of President Emeritus Frederick L. Hubde, Robert Eccles of the Department of History, interviewing. This is recorded for the Purdue University Archives and to be used by accredited persons. Well, sir, the last time we were talking about your Rhodes Scholarship and your, I think we more or less finished your life in Europe connected with the scholarship, and I believe our next general subject is graduate work and degrees and your return to the United States.
In my undergraduate work at Oxford, I studied for the so-called Final Honor School of Chemistry. And that work consisted of two parts, the BA degree followed by the Bachelor of Science degree, which is awarded for a further year study and a research paper. At the end of my second year at Oxford, my tutor, T.W.J. Taylor of Brasenose, was awarded a Rhodes Traveling Fellowship and spent a year in the USA. Prior to his leaving, he assigned me to do my part two, or the research part of the Bachelor of Science degree, to a young physical chemist of St. John's College, Oxford, by the name of Harold W. Thompson. Harold Thompson was a brilliant young man at the time, had returned from Oxford after completing an advanced degree at one of the German universities, and had earlier, before that, had graduated from Oxford. Thompson was a protege of the world-famous physical chemist at Oxford, Hinshelwood. Hinshelwood at that time and his co-workers were interested in the physical chemistry of reactions, chemical reactions in the gaseous phase, and were interested in expounding and determining and describing the nature of so-called chain reactions, the rapid chemical reactions that take place in the gaseous phase. I then became acquainted, of course, with H.W. Thompson and worked in the old chemical laboratories. Next to the Dyson-Perrins chemical labs, which were located across the street from Rhodes House in Oxford.
Just the beginning of the land of the Always Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
North Oxford.
In a sense, that was right. The first problem that Thompson and I tackled that October, when term began, was to elucidate and describe the nature of the reaction that takes place when carbonyl sulfide reacts with oxygen to produce carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide. It's a rather complicated reaction. We attempted to study this reaction, the nature of the chain reaction, by making carbonyl sulfide and mixing it with various quantities of oxygen and under various pressures to determine the temperature and pressure variables which were necessary to make the reaction take place rapidly, or in the form of an explosive reaction. Well, this proved to be, with the techniques we had available at the time, a very, very difficult task. And then other phenomena came in to interfere with our ability to reproduce our results in the laboratory with the techniques we were then using. By this time, half the year had passed, and it was obvious that there was no successful result could be achieved. So in the middle of the year, we changed problems, and I had to start all over again. The second problem that I worked on was the influence of the inert gases on the reaction of hydrogen and oxygen, simple reaction of burning hydrogen, in the presence of other gases, the inert gases in particular, to determine the effect of the inert gases upon the propagation of the chain reaction that occurs when hydrogen burns an oxygen. Well, this was a problem which we devised a mechanism that we could study, and this produced a satisfactory research paper by the end of the term. The interesting part of this experience was the fact that Thompson himself was my age, and we worked together in the laboratories, and he was never too busy or too preoccupied to spend time with me. And so it was a very enjoyable experience. And in addition, he had been a soccer blue at Oxford, so he had a great interest in athletics. I remember one pleasant week we both took off from Oxford to go down into southern England, a very attractive little pub hotel where we played some golf and then worked on the preparation of my thesis.
A reading and research party?
In a way, yeah. But we enjoyed it very much, too. We had work and play both. And, of course, Thompson is now a fellow of the Royal Society and was knighted several years ago. He's Sir Harold Thompson. He later switched his physical chemistry interest to the study of infrared spectroscopy. He became world famous for his work on infrared spectroscopy as an analytical tool in the field of physical chemistry. But in retrospect, this was a fortunate choice of fortunate happenstance that I was assigned to Thompson, and through him became acquainted with Hinshelwood, who was a remarkable man of tremendous influence in Oxford life, particularly at Trinity College, where Hinshelwood was located, and with all the young people in the science schools at Oxford. Spring of 32 rolled around, I had completed and received the Bachelor of Science Part 2 and had accepted a instructorship at the University of Minnesota in the chemical engineering department. And my work with Thompson that year had fired my interest in the study of gaseous reactions, reactions in the gaseous phase. And in particular, I had an idea that I'd like to work with Dr. Lind of the University of Minnesota, who was a pioneer American chemist in the field of radioactive chemistry. I thought I might like to do some work at Minnesota then, while I was an instructor with Lind on studying the influence of radioactive materials on gaseous reactions. However, this was not to come about, because when I returned to Minnesota that August, I was invited to talk with Dr. Malcolm McLean, who had been appointed director of the newly formed experimental college at Minnesota called the General College. Did we talk about that earlier?
No, we have not.
Well, this experience that August was, in a sense, the turning point of my professional life, because I had made all the arrangements to take my instructorship and start this work with Dr. Lind when McLean called me in to see him one Saturday morning. Being a brash and certainly then uninformed young man about education, I argued with Dr. McLean for 3 hours that morning about the General College and what it was established to do, and what they proposed to, the studies they proposed to make, and so on. At the end of this 3 hour period, McLean asked if I would join him as assistant director and help him put this college into being when term opened that September. This meant a, for me at least, a serious reevaluation of what I was going to do with myself. After a week's thinking about it and so on, I finally told McLean that I would join him in this venture. And in retrospect, this probably was the most important single personal decision that I ever made for myself, or ever had to face. General College, as conceived by the University of Minnesota at that time, was to be a unit of the university into which all freshmen admitted to the university, for whom prognosis of academic success in the traditional degree programs was very, very poor. In other words, the lowest one quarter of the entering students in terms, the lowest quarter as measured by their high school performance and Minnesota College aptitude tests, were to be assigned to the General College. The theory of the academic program was that over a two-year span, this group of young men and women were to be given the best general education the university could provide, the most broad, comprehensive look at American society institutions. And coupled with this, an intensive counseling program to make each individual aware of himself as an individual, his talents, his abilities, his interests, his handicaps, his liabilities, and to attempt through the counseling procedure to make these young people face up to the fact that as individuals, they had to face facts in terms of their own personalities, their own future place in the workaday world. And if this were done wisely and intelligently and with full understanding, that they could be valuable people, that they could have real happiness, they could be contributors and so on. General College was given the right to ask any of the faculty of the university, best teachers, most outstanding individuals, to develop these general education courses. And the faculty that had been assembled by Dr. McLean consisted of many of the very leading people at the University of Minnesota, all of whom were deeply interested in the challenge represented. Some very interesting survey courses had been developed. For instance, Dr. Casey, who was then head of journalism at Minnesota, developed a general education course called The Formation of Public Opinion. Several of the leading people in economics developed a general survey course called Basic Wealth, which dealt with the basic factors that are operative in the economy of this country or any other country. In English, instead of the typical freshman English course, where the registrant wrote his weekly paper and was graded, all the students were assigned to what we call the writing laboratory, where they did their compositions in the writing laboratory under with help and direction, on the theory that in the process of writing good English, that if help was provided at the time the writing was done, that the common kinds of errors and that are found in freshman writing could be corrected and be made more meaningful in the correction. Okay. Then we set up for the university the first audiovisual department for the university. And attempted into the direction of the director of the audiovisual division to provide for every instructor and for every course access to and the ability to have all the equipment at any class, in any place, at any time, use audiovisual materials of all kinds. Every instructor of these large classes were taught in large groups, but every professor had assigned to him several graduate students who attended these classes, took notes, and worked under the direction of the specialists in examination in the educational research group at Minnesota. And for each class, every week, new and interesting ways of devising questions for examining purposes were produced by these students. Then in the examinations given in the, during the course of the term, the questions were all put through the process of validation to determine whether or not a given question would do the job the question was designed to do, namely differentiate those who knew and those who were good from those who didn't know and those who weren't any good, didn't know the answer. And by this technique, over several years' time for all these courses, we built a body of validated test questions so that in a large class, say, of 300 or 400 students taking an examination, they could devise two completely different examinations, different questions and so on, which would produce the same result in terms of the grades achieved by these exams. The professor was almost independent of the examining process by this technique we used, but he also was involved with his graduate student assistants in the preparation of the examinations, all of which were the objective type, and there are many different interesting new kinds of objective type test questions developed by the students with large classes and so on. The problem of grades and grading and so on is a real one, always is a real one, as long as you use the grading system in the universities. And on the whole, there are very few people in the university who really understand examinations. It's a tricky, tricky business.
You bet it is.
And on the counseling side, well, we had a lot of other interesting courses that were developed. Art appreciation. Did some very interesting work in that field. Music appreciation. Survey of physics and chemistry I taught. This was a kind of a combination course of basic physics and chemistry, which in our wisdom, we thought that this group could assimilate and master and give them a sufficient basic background as to what science is and what it can do and what it can't do. What its meaning was in the life and times of our people and the world. Human biology, the dean of the medical school, who then dean of the medical school, taught that course. And this was human biology really laid its principal emphasis on the understanding of the human body. All of us, of course, have to live within our own bodies. I suppose you ought to understand something about what it is. Counseling part of it, however, was interesting. When we started, McLean and I were the two principal counselors. McLean was, in my judgment, the finest counselor of students, and others for that matter, I have ever known or seen in operation. We had the feeling that good instruction could only be achieved if the instructor knew what he was working with, knew the nature of the people in his classroom. And we had a grant from the General Education Board in those years to describe that particular portion of the collegiate population as best we could, on the theory that if we could describe this portion of the collegiate population, then we could do a better job in terms of curriculum, a better job in terms of preparing them for productive life work. Basically, you see, the problem with this group of students was that they'd come to the university with the vague notion that they wanted to, well, with the desire that they wanted to hitch their wagon to a star, but not realizing that nature had not endowed them with the requisite intellectual or other qualities, or if they had good basic talents, they hadn't yet been developed. The environment, forces impinging upon them that prevented this development in high school. But many of them were disadvantaged in the sense that they had poor economic and family backgrounds. The home had not been a place of learning. So McLean and I carried an enormous load of personal counseling. We knew every student. We started that fall with some 400 students. The theory was that if they did well in their general college courses, then we would recommend that they could be transferred to any other division of the university, which they might have elected to achieve a degree objective if they had demonstrated that they had the academic competence. Well, what you found, of course, from the counseling procedure is that all these youngsters did have strengths and weaknesses, talents and abilities, and that the problem was to make them understand themselves, to be willing to work to remedy their weaknesses and their lack of academic understanding and knowledge in areas of their weaknesses, that they should set for themselves objectives to develop their talents and to seek to develop competence in things they could do successfully, and that this might involve a vocational program, contradistinction to a professional intellectual program. But once the idea got across to the individual that this is the right way to go, and out of it he could become a competent person and be a valued and needed person and get great satisfaction, then you are successful in the counseling procedure. Now, the sequel. One of the interesting stories directly involving myself came to light many years later. Last year's Nobel Peace Prize winner was Norman Borlaug. Norman Borlaug was a distinguished plant breeder who worked on the development of the wheats in Mexico, which were so important to the tropical countries, Mexico, Pakistan, principally. Borlaug was on the campus 5 or 6 years ago. He was with the dean of the graduate school, Fred Andrews, and was here to see some of his colleagues and friends in the plant breeding work, the School of Agriculture. And in the course of his time with Dr. Andrews, he said he'd like to see President Hubdy. Andrew said, do you know President Hebbie? Borlaug said, oh yes. He was my counselor when I was a freshman at the General College, University of Minnesota.
Is that so?
And I wouldn't be here today if it weren't for Fred Hebbie.
Well, I'll be darned.
Well, Norman Borlaug was a boy from a poor farming community, or rather a farming community, you know, whether they were poor or not. But Northern Iowa had very little high school, a very poor education. In some respects, you'd describe him as a disadvantaged white boy. But evidently, by his own admission, the counseling process evidently got him on the right track, because he transferred to the School of Agriculture and later became one of the world's famous plant breeders. Only one man a year gets the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, it paid
that,
off.
In that sense, it paid off. The interesting part about it was that all the techniques and all the new experimental work in general education in Minnesota antedated the famous Harvard report on general education, which came out in the late 30s. We'd been doing all this in Minnesota long before Harvard discovered general education. Furthermore, the work in examinations and the work in audiovisual aids, the writing labs and the other experimental things we did in the college were soon adopted by the entire university. We pioneered and developed these things, and then they were adopted by the rest of the university. So in that sense, it was a fascinating and useful experiment. By the end of the fourth year, by the beginning of the fourth year of the college, the student body was up to around 1,600. And at that time, at the end of the fourth year, I left the university to go to the University of Rochester. I knew that my own career in educational administration had to be, had to have other facets and other experiences if I were to get anywhere.
Did you continue with your PhD work too?
No, it was impossible. Once I started in the General College with the load the two of us carried, then what time I had to study and so on, I was studying material related to administration. Education administration, counseling, psychology, and this kind of thing.
You just didn't have time to spend in the lab.
Well, I didn't have the long hours that were required, because we were working 8, 10, 12 hours a day at the General College program, and trying to build an esprit de corps and a pride and a fruitful experience for these 1,500 kids. Every one of them is a problem, just like every person has a bundle of problems. I don't care what their talents are, abilities or liabilities are, everyone's a bundle of problems, a bundle of human problems. But this experience with the General College as an experimental college, doing so many things which were then kind of pioneering, then really educational pioneering work, was probably the single most valuable educational experience that I had in what then became my career, namely educational administration.
How did you get your offer for Rochester? Did it come through recommendation, McLean, or?
The president of the University of Rochester at that time was Alan Valentine. Alan Valentine was a ahead of me as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. He had gone to the University of Rochester in 1935, and he was looking around during that year for staff, and one of the positions he had open was looking for an executive assistant. He visited Minnesota, and he came, asked me to see him at the time. And after I saw him, I made a visit to Rochester, and then he invited me to come to Rochester as an executive assistant to the president. Rochester at that time was a private institution, or still is. It had the largest endowment per student of any American university, including Harvard.
It would be including Rice, too.
Because Eastman, Eastman died about 1932 and left his whole fortune to the University of Rochester. Eastman, during his lifetime, had made major gifts to, anonymously, to MIT. But when he died, he left his fortune to the University of Rochester. So, from 1936 until 1941, I worked at Rochester as executive assistant to the president. I ran a scholarship program that he introduced, the Rochester Prize Scholarship Program. I gave a lecture, general education lecture course in chemistry in the college, and then did all kinds of jobs, sort of looked after the development of the management of the athletic, intercollegiate athletic program at Rochester, for one thing. Participated in the old university committees on curriculum and this kind of typical chore. And like most executive assistants to the president, was the person who listened to the faculty and the other administrative officers who wanted to filter things through to the president. Executive assistant to the president sort of was a liaison person. People in the faculty would tell the executive assistant things, they never would tell the president face to face. That kind of thing, you know.
Yeah. There's only one thing you've neglected up to now, excuse me. But let's come to it. You were a bachelor at this time?
Well, if you want me to go back to Mrs. Upton.
Well, no, but all of a sudden it occurred to me that she mentioned a friend of mine who I knew at Oxford as being a friend of hers at Rochester. And he came from Virginia.
Virginia Bowers?
No, he was a very, his Aunt Pendleton.
Oh, did you know Pendleton?
Yes.
Where did you know Pendleton?
He was in his last year at Oxford when I was there.
Oh. Well, Pendleton I knew at Oxford. He came up, I think, about my last year.
Mm-hmm.
Pendleton later then came to the English department
at
the University of Rochester.
Yes. He got an LLB, I think, in English at Oxford.
That I don't remember because I wasn't there when he finished, but he and he was one of the young men that came to Rochester in the English department at the time I was there. Well, when I returned from Oxford, I'd met Mrs. Hubby my senior year at Minnesota. And in the summer of my first year at Oxford, she brought a group of girls over to Europe. Tour that she had organized. This was the summer of 1930. There were 14 girls in the party and four mothers. I knew most of the girls, most of them were University of Minnesota girls. I joined the group that traveled with him for a couple of weeks, Holland, the Rhine, Switzerland, Paris, that kind of thing. Had a good time with them. When Zebedee returned home that August, she wrote and said she wasn't going to wait around for 2 more years till I came home. She'd always been a popular girl and had no lack of suitors. I wrote her a letter once a week for 2 years. And she never replied. I got home in August of 1932. A few days after I arrived home, I went to out one evening to see friends of mine. And while I was at their home, Priscilla and the boy she was engaged to came in to join the evening group. Well, I got back in the running again. And a year later, in 1933, we were married and had a wonderful life.
Well, I wondered, you hadn't mentioned that this, but I knew that you were married when you went to Rochester, from what
well,
I heard.
I started my first year at the General College. I was a bachelor. And seeing her again, and after that first year, we were married in August of 1933, and she continued to work. She was working at the, she was in charge of the department down at Atkinson's, one of the big department stores. She was very, very efficient and very, very good at her job. And she continued to work until our son was born the following year. Then, our first child. And we made the move to Rochester, and of course, through my position there and president. We met all the leading people in the city of Rochester. We took a home in Rochester, and across the street lived a young couple, Bill, Mr. and Mrs. William S. Vaughn. Vaughn turned out, he was with Eastman Kodak Company, and he turned out to be a Rhodes Scholar who had been up just ahead of me at Oxford. His wife had been, was an accomplished musician and had been organist for Mr. Eastman. They lived across the street. Bob not only was a Rhodes Scholar from Vanderbilt, but also a member of my fraternity, the Horse Pie House. And so we had neighbors who were just about our own age. Bill Vaughn later became president of Kodak, but then came on the board of Kodak, had a distinguished career with that company. And through them we met all the Kodak people. And had a very, very delightful time in the city of Rochester.
And this was the period from 36 to the...
36 to
outbreak of
the winter of 41. War had broken out in England and Europe in what, 39?
39, September 39.
By September 40, Britain was struggling. The air battle for Britain was going on in September 40. The British sent over a group of their top scientists. There was Sir Henry Tizard, Professor Fowler, famous physicist from Cambridge, and Professor Cockcroft. The National Defense Research Committee had been organized in this country under the leadership of Van Bush and Dr. Conant of Harvard, K.T. Compton of MIT. In the summer of spring of 40, when the British team came over in the fall of 1940, they came with, empowered by Winston Churchill to tell us everything about their research program, all the secret things. And the most important at that time was radar. Mm-hmm. This had been developed in England and put in place by the time the war broke out and enabled Britain to win the air battle, defeat the German airplanes by air. There were only 400 Spitfires and Hurricanes in the Royal Air Force. And in order for those 400 to fight off the German day bombing, they had to go up only when the bombers were coming. They couldn't patrol constantly. And the radar told them when they were coming.
That's right.
Not only when they were coming, but where they were coming. And so the Spitfires and Hurricanes won the air battle for Britain. Well, these three British scientists visited all our groups in this country working on defense research, military research. And the NDRC then organized a return visit under Dr. Conant. Christmas vacation, I was in Chicago. Each Christmas vacation, I made a tour of the Midwestern high schools in the interest of the Rochester Scholarship Program. I was in Chicago, and I received a call from a man by the name of Carol Wilson, who was Van Bush's executive assistant. Earlier that fall, Professor Lee DeBridge, who was head of physics at Rochester, had left the university to go to what was called the radiation lab at MIT. Then several other people from the University of Rochester had been seconded and disappeared from the campus to take other jobs in the war effort. And I got a call from Carol Wilson and asked if I would be interested in talking with him and Van Bush about joining the National Defense Research Committee and going to England. Well, I said I'd let him know as soon as I got home and talked to my wife. I got home right after Christmas and talked with this fellow. And I told her at the time, I said, before it's over, we'll be in the war.
Certainly.
And this is important, and I want to do it. And he said, fine. So I called Carol Wilson and said, yes. And I went down to Washington. Talked with Dr. Bush. They said, all right, you're going to be one of a party of three under Dr. Conant. You and Carol Wilson are going to England to return this visit. And then you'll stay in England to set up the office for the exchange of scientific information, both coming and going, and provide official liaison with all the British scientific effort, all the scientific committees of the ministries, Ministry of Supply, the Ministry of Aircraft Production, the Admiralty, the whole shooting match. So on February 15th, Conant and Wilson and I boarded ship in New York Harbor, February 15th.
41.
Yeah. American Export Lines ship en route to Lisbon. Well, the ship, we weren't in the war, and as the ship crossed the Atlantic, it was like a Christmas tree at night. We had a great American flag painted on the side of the ship. And this sort of to tell the German submarines that this was an American ship, not the torpedo. On the shipboard, Conant and Wilson and myself, three or four other Americans, and the five or six Japanese who kept to themselves, they were on the way to Berlin, behind the German curtain. That time behind the passenger complement was very small, just a few people. In the American group was Tracy Murrow, brother of Ed Murrow. Tracy Murrow was in civilian clothes but was being sent by the Air Force to study airfields in Great Britain. He was an engineer, he was chief engineer for the state of Washington, and Murrow was an unhappy man at that particular junction because the state engineer he was involved in the construction of and the later collapse of the famous Tacoma Bridge.
It's the darndest thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Another one of the group on board was a Time Life correspondent, the name of Bill Bayless. Was an interesting man who spent a good deal of time in Germany and had written a book about Hitler and his people surrounding Hitler. The book was called Caesars and Goose Death. We arrived in Lisbon, and Lisbon was a fascinating place at that time. We stayed out at Estoril in the Grand Hotel. And this was a crossroads for both warring worlds.
And for
it was the entryway into North Africa, it was the entryway into Spain, France, Italy, Germany.
And all the espionage.
And then the people bound for England flew into England, into southern England, on the Dutch DC-3s, which had gotten out of Holland. Dutch Airlines pilots and their DC-3s. We were in Lisbon a few days, and in comes Ambassador Winant's party. He'd been appointed ambassador. And Winant learned that Conant was waiting for his turn with Wilson and myself to get into England. So Winant took Conant with him and left Wilson and I behind. There wasn't room for two of us, but he took Conant. Conant was with Winant when Winant arrived, and of course was in on all the festivities of welcoming Winant, the king and the queen and the prime minister and everybody else. So it was valuable that Conant went ahead with the ambassador. Well, it took us about a week before our turn came, and then we flew into London, flew into southern England somewhere. I don't know where they went.
Could the Germans have shot you down and didn't want to kill you?
Oh, yes, I think so. Out over the Bay of Biscay.
Intercept from Bordeaux or from...
From
Quiberon. La Harbor is north. No. But it could have been done.
Cherbourg. The big port. Le Havre.
Yeah.
When we arrived, Wilson and I joined Conant, and then we went on a rapid-fire tour of all the principal British scientific laboratories. And of course, wherever we walked, we were welcomed with open arms, shown everything, and was set up for me, who was to remain, to be a ex officio and liaison member of all the top committees, and the orderly transmission of documents and reports, research reports, and all that sort of thing.
Were you officially working through the embassy?
Well, I was assigned an office in the embassy, but I didn't report to the ambassador except for housekeeping.
Yeah, well, but on the table of organization, you were with the embassy.
I was given space and facilities and service in the embassy. And but I was completely free to transmit my intelligence and my report directly to Washington to Van Bush's organization, State Department and the Military Defense, Department of the Army, Department of Navy. While I worked with the naval attaché and the military attachés and so on, I was independent. And the final crux of Conant's visit, forgotten the date in March, was a meeting in London at the Royal Society. The rooms in Burlington House were jammed with people standing. Conant gave a talk, and when he finished, the entire crowd jumped to their feet and cheered and clapped and yelled. It just sent shivers up and down your spine. See the membership of the Royal Society, all the top scientists and women who were there. Here was tangible evidence that we were their friends and deserved the help. We went out there in the war. That wasn't fun until December of 41. But it was a thrilling day.
As you look back on it, was there ever any doubt that we would not get into the war? England
well,
side.
Of course, Churchill's policy right from the word go was to get us into the war.
That is right.
And of course, while it was not likely that the Germans were going to do anything like sink the Lusitania, such an eventuality could always happen.
Yeah.
And but I don't think at that time any of us thought that Japan would be foolish enough to do what it did. But Japan presumably thought the golden opportunity had come and made the attack on Pearl Harbor that December. That December afternoon, December 7th, I was down at the Telecommunications Research Establishment, the southern coast of England, where they had big laboratory set up working on radar problems and other things. And I remember it was a Sunday and about tea time, a large group of us gathered in the local hotel having tea, and a lot of Englishmen working at the TRE, as it was called, and the news came through of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And of course, the first news indicated that our Pacific fleet had been partially destroyed or almost totally destroyed.
Well, this was a blow, but
the Englishmen knew then that we were in the war, and you never saw such happy people in your lifetime, even though they were unhappy that our Pacific fleet had taken a terrible blow. And this was, of course, a turning point as far as this country was concerned.
And then you were in it. Were you given a military rank?
Oh, no. MDRC, which later became OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development, was a civilian organization. Mm-hmm. And Van Bush kept it that way.
Yeah.
And in many respects, this was a good thing, because if you become a military organization, then you've been subject to military tradition and military abhorrence of anything new. Strange thing about the military mind, they only wanted to go with trusted and tried weapons, and they wouldn't try new things.
Always of the war previous.
Yeah, generally. Well, I mean, it's illustrated by the attitude of some of the Navy captains when radar was first installed on the Navy ships. The early installations, of course, gave a lot of technical troubles. And they had those radar masts up on the top of the ship, and the captains would complain and say, "Get that gimmick stuff off my ship," you know, not realizing that.
That's why the English sunk the Italian fleet. The Germans had the radar, as you know, and wouldn't give it to the Italians.
Yeah.
Well, you spent the rest of the war in England on this job?
No. Well, my original commitment was to go for 6 months or possibly a year. We weren't at war, you see.
No.
And I came back in September of 1941 for vacation to see what was going on in our labs. And then my oldest daughter was born while I was home. I spent a month at home, the month of September, and then returned to England. And I stayed on around till the following, I forgot now, March or April. And then I ran with Bennett Archambault, took my place, and I came back to Washington to be executive assistant to Dr. Conant.
He was back here prior to your...
Well, he was head of the mission that returned the British visit. And when he came back, of course, he was president of Harvard, and he was also chairman of the National Defense Research Committee. But he wasn't about to stay in England. He was the head man, and that set it all up. Carol Wilson came back to Washington and was in charge of the Washington liaison office. I was in charge of the London liaison office. Well, that's enough. 10:30. That's enough for the day. We'll talk about
all right.
More next time.
This is the end of tape 3 of a series of interviews with President Emeritus F.L. Hubdy, Purdue University. End of tape.